From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Among public broadcasting's funders, which most affects programming?
I find really ironic that people are critical of big corporations. The irony is that I think that's a greater problem with foundations than it's ever been with a corporation.
Also, we'll talk to an internet publisher in Delhi about a journalist-run sting operation that almost brought down the Indian government.
And how do you get a good blurb for a movie like Battlefield Earth?
They put together like ransom notes, you know, a word at a time.
Plus, we'll find out how Congress handles constituents in cyberspace in this edition of On the Media. First, this news.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the leaders of India's government took back what they said last week about a news operation called Tehelka, which means sensation. The government had condemned the web-based news service that, by means of a sting operation, caught leaders of India's military on the take in virtually every office. In the last 2 weeks, the nation has watched hours of videotape gathered by Tehelka reporters of money passed across desks and stuffed in drawers, and greed so widespread it threatened to bring down the government. This was regarded as the most stable government India had had in years, and now, because of Tehelka, 6 ministers have resigned and the Prime Minister, A.B. Vajpayee, is left to clean up the mess and rebuild his shrunken majority.
Tarun Tejpal is the publisher of Tehelka.com, and over a nearly 20-year career, he's reported for some of India's most highly regarded newspapers and magazines. Mr. Tejpal, on the face of it, the plan seems crazy. 2 young reporters with new suits and about 20 grand in bribe money faking their way to the top of India's military food chain. How did the idea come together, and what made you think you could pull it off?
There is a background to all this. India has been convulsed by controversies about defense deals since the mid-80s. For the last 15 years, we've had problems about defense deals. And in 1989, the Indian government actually banned defense middlemen. The truth is, anybody who lives in Delhi and moves in a particular set knows that Delhi is full of very, very wealthy defense middlemen. So the idea was to actually just start at the bottom, go with a dummy product, a dummy company, and see how far you could take it and what was the scale of corruption. They're very fine reporters, but they're complete novices when it comes to military hardware and financial sort of skullduggery. And they made several gaffes, but the greed was so blinding that none of these guys who we ran this thing on could even catch on.
Let's talk about a couple of those gaffes that you referred to. I mean, some of them are actually kind of funny. When one of them was asked where he stayed in London, he replied, because he'd never been out of India, Manchester United. And that didn't even set off any alarm bells.
That was pretty hysterical, yeah. But I think the funniest was when one of them asked this fellow, he said, well, what is the range of your handheld camera? And he said, unlimited. So this guy was a little puzzled. He said, it blows after a point.
Let's talk about the fallout in India. I mean, India had a government that looked pretty stable, pretty clean. This was after decades of what is now the opposition party in office. Describe the political moment in India and what the fallout has been from this scandal.
The fallout has been basically all hell has broken loose here. The one thing I made sure we didn't do, and I particularly didn't do, was I did not think about what the fallout of the story would be, who would gain, who would lose, who would leverage it, how. Because if we'd done that, we would have never finished the story. We are not really concerned with the politics of it, because I knew what would happen. And exactly that and worse has happened, because every political party actually just jumped onto the bandwagon and tried to leverage the story in any which way they could, not just political parties, individuals, groups, everyone. The government has also behaved badly. I mean, they ran a slander campaign against us. They called it a national conspiracy, an international conspiracy, all kinds of things, you know.
No major American news organization would ever have done anything like this. Do you think this kind of gotcha journalism or entrapment is appropriate?
You have to remember that there's a great thick skin operating here. I mean, all I keep saying is, suppose this story had been a print story in a newspaper, nobody would have even bothered to reply. I mean, this was hardcore audio visual evidence, getting wall-to-wall sort of coverage in the networks, and even then they brazened it out. There's a kind of hierarchy of corruption, and it's so high here at the moment that the only way to combat it is with extraordinary means.
Is it okay to use certain journalistic techniques in one place and not in another?
Like I keep saying, I mean, I didn't have a shadow of doubt about the ethics of the investigation because we didn't get into anyone's private lives. Mm-hmm. Nothing. The entire investigation concerned people in public offices abusing public trust and public money. And people like these need to be nailed in whatever way you can. For me, that is the core job of journalism, to actually, you know, keep an eye on governance. All I'm saying is there is a difference between the climate in, say, in the United States and the climate in India. A lot of what people get away with here, people would not get away with there, you know. The systems of sort of accountability and policing, it seems to me from a distance, mostly Hollywood movies, of course, is are far more efficient than they are in India.
Perhaps. Tarun Tejpal, editor of Tehelka, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tarun Tejpal spoke to us from Delhi.
This week, viewers of Black entertainment television witnessed a true media moment. On Tuesday, BET's president Robert Johnson took an hour of prime time to explain why he'd fired high-profile interviewer Tavis Smiley. He explained that Smiley had violated his contract by selling an interview to ABC before he shopped it to BET. Plus, his ratings were low. Then, on the nationally syndicated Tom Joyner program, Smiley shot back.
What's next? Ebony versus Essence? The very thought of this kind of black-on-black verbal nihilism sickens me. Black America can ill afford this kind of wretched public display of black-on-black character assassination and personal destruction.
Many viewers who called or sent Mr. Johnson emails thought that if BET weren't owned by a conglomerate which cared more about MTV and CBS, Smiley's fame and journalistic reputation would trump ratings or contractual quibbles. Smiley saw it that way.
I find it even more curious that Mr. Johnson would move to dismiss me for selling one mainstream interview to a mainstream network when he sold the entire company to Viacom. Issue two, with regard to Mr. Johnson's allegation of Tom Joyner spreading information, my response is simple. If Bob Johnson still owned BET, Tom would have referred the calls to him.
Think about how remarkable it is for a network head to take an hour of prime time to explain a personnel decision. Once upon a time in the land of media, they canceled what they wanted to cancel, and we just had to deal with it. But now the audiences are smaller and the stakes are therefore higher. In a way, it reminds me of the situation with San Francisco's newspapers.
Conveniently, we have the editor of the San Francisco Chronicle sitting in a studio in San Francisco.
But before we get to Phil Bronstein, let's talk about the San Francisco newspaper war. Like BET, like all media, a deep-pocketed owner is vying for the affections and therefore the attention of an audience. For 35 years, the city's two papers, The Chronicle and The Examiner, were journalistic competitors but business partners under a joint operating agreement. Then the owners of The Examiner bought The Chronicle. The Chronicle's new owner, the Hearst Corporation, merged the Examiner's staff with the Chronicle's. That's why Phil Bronstein went from being the editor of the Examiner to executive editor of the Chronicle.
The story goes that when Mr. Bronstein was with the Examiner, he once donned scuba gear to get an exclusive interview with an alligator that had taken up residence in a city park. That bravery will come in handy as he tries to navigate the new newspaper landscape. Mr. Bronstein, I want to begin by talking about your old paper. The Examiner still exists, but only so that the Chronicle can avoid a monopoly. The Hearst Corporation has propped it up with $66 million, and it's run by a politically connected local family better known for weekly shopping papers than Pulitzer Prizes. Is the Examiner real competition for the Chronicle?
I would like there to be a competitive newspaper. But I can't say that the New Examiner has been a lot of competition journalistically.
And leaving San Francisco out for a moment, do you agree with most of the media watchdogs who worry about two newspaper and three newspaper towns becoming one newspaper towns?
I think if the one newspaper that's left allows itself to settle into complacency, it's a big concern. But I have to tell you that any newspaper, and certainly for our newspaper, The Chronicle, that sees the competition only as other competing media is very short-sighted. The competition is for the hearts and minds of the readers. There's an emotional connection that is lacking between readers and their newspapers. The sense that this is my newspaper, damn it, it helps me tell me how to live my life. It instructs me, it informs me, it entertains me. And that is the biggest challenge that we face.
Well, this battle for hearts and minds that you talk about seems to be a particularly arduous one in San Francisco. David Shaw, the Pulitzer Prize-winning media writer for the LA Times, wrote, "This magical, mythical city by the bay has never had newspapers whose quality even remotely approached the aspirations of its populace." Why hasn't it?
I think part of it was the joint operating agreement. You've got two masters, basically, two different companies that each have a 50% share in this thing, and therefore neither one really is able to create an aggressive direction for the paper. We're free of that now. You know, now is really the test as to how much that was a factor. Then I think you've got a long history of a reputation, you know, the famous line from All the President's Men, where they, you know, some wacky story and the editor of the Washington Post says, give it to the San Francisco Chronicle. I mean, some of that reputation was because Scott Newhall, who was the editor of the Chronicle in the 60s, decided to make it a fun paper. And he's the guy who came up with the famous headline, you know, "Great City Forced to Drink Swill," which is about bad coffee. But it got the reputation of being goofy.
Now you have a staff that is enormous. You have people who have long been assigned to the same beats, now still covering them cheek by jowl. In the case of the Knight Ritter-owned San Jose Mercury, the publisher, Jay Harris, left because of an insistence by Knight Ritter that the profit margin increase over what it was. The paper was making a profit. They wanted to make a higher profit, and that necessitated some massive staff cuts. Now, Hearst isn't famous for resisting bottom-line pressures either. Why wouldn't there be staff cuts, especially when the staff is now so huge?
Well, there was a promise when this whole ordeal started a couple of years ago that no one would lose their job. There'd be no involuntary layoffs, and Hearst is committed to that, and I know they're committed to that, and there haven't been, and they're not going to be. I mean, yes, there's not only pressure because you've merged two staffs and you might have two widget critics, but, you know, there's pressure because the economy is in a downturn. But we're still proceeding. We've got this brand new Sunday newspaper that we're going to debut on the 29th of April, which is going to have new sections in it. If you build it, they will come.
So, Phil Bronstein, how do you measure success? Is it scoops? Is it Pulitzers? Is it circulation? Is it profit margin?
I suppose when the next time we talk or there's an introduction, instead of talking about the goofy stunt that we pulled in the dog days of a summer between conventions, that you say, you know, he's a Pulitzer finalist for his work in the Philippines. Now, I realize the alligator thing is much sexier in some bizarre way, but I would just like for the Great City Forced to Drink Swill reputation, the backwater of journalism reputation, to change. So people say, the San Francisco Chronicle, that is the Bay Area. I live in the Bay Area. That's my paper.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Phil Bronstein is the executive editor of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Coming up, we look into congressional email, corporate mouthpieces, and the impact of foundation grants on public broadcasting.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Genghis C. and Kubla T. Khan Foundation. Visit us on the web at goldenhorde.org.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Email, it's changing the world, revolutionizing communication, redefining democracy. The only problem is no one CC'd the U.S. Congress. A recent study conducted by the Congressional Management Foundation and the George Washington University shows that members of the Senate and House routinely ignore and misunderstand email. Joining me now is Rick Shapiro, and he's the executive director of the Congressional Management Foundation. Welcome to On the Media, Rick.
Glad to be here.
So how bad is it?
Well, we think it's creating a communications crisis in Congress because there is a public that is expecting rapid responses to their email and not receiving them. And there's a Congress that's expecting the public to be much more understanding of their limitations and is getting frustrated that they're not. And so there really is a need for both sides to really change their expectations and their practices.
So specifically, what are you seeing? Members of Congress aren't reading the email? They're junking them? They're ignoring them?
We're seeing a couple of problems. First, when they're getting emails from non-constituents, from people outside their district or state, they are simply ignoring them. And that's the large majority of emails that congressional offices are receiving. And so you have a concerned citizen out there in the public who's written an email and said, I'm very concerned about this issue. You're the lead senator on this issue, and they're getting no response whatsoever, and they're frustrated.
We sent an email to every senator, everyone except for Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who didn't accept any email, and 30 senators who said they'd only respond to constituents. The email we sent was one line. It said, please support legislation to ban bear traps. We received only 30 responses, some up to a week after we sent the original email. None addressed the issue of bear traps. Almost all said they'd respond only by the U.S. mail. One senator, Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, cited security constraints as a reason he couldn't respond. What constraints?
When you survey or talk to congressional offices, there is a strong common view that email will be tampered with, and therefore congressional offices should respond with a hard copy letter and a signature.
You think they just have a heightened suspicion of email because they don't get it?
I think they have a heightened suspicion of email because it's just so new to them. But I think what they're missing is constituents simply expect that when they write their members of Congress online that they're going to get an online response, and it's going to be faster than 3 weeks.
Your report suggests that part of the problem comes from grassroots organizations and their mass emails. You think that if they could limit their activity to constituents corresponding with their congressmen, it would be much more effective and would glut up the system a lot less?
What I think Congress needs and what would be much, much more effective is for the grassroots organizations to say there are limitations. If you want to be heard, the best way for a constituent to be heard, the best way for us to help voices be heard is to make sure people who are writing their senator, their congressperson, and not sending mass emails to everybody in Congress.
Now, your report is 20 pages long, but can you briefly summarize how you think some of the more endemic problems can be dealt with?
There's ways of automating this whole process, which is what the best offices are doing. The real issue is that most congressional offices simply aren't aware that that technology exists, and then once they are made aware of it, they don't have the technical capability in-house in their offices to say, how do you make this system work?
Rick Shapiro, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke. Appreciate it.
Rick Shapiro is the executive director of the Congressional Management Foundation. And now, some of your letters to On the Media.
$200,000 and worth every penny. He was the voice I waited for on NPR, and his replacements suck. Listener John Spielberg from Philadelphia is, of course, referring to ex-Connection host and, for the moment at least, public radio exile, Christopher Lydon. Our March 17th interview with Mr. Lydon prompted responses by the email equivalent of the sack load. Concerning OTM's coverage of the firing, Larry Stein from Seattle voiced a commonly held sentiment that we tripped up by talking only to Mr. Lydon. Although it may not mean much in the larger scheme of things, said Mr. Stein, the issue did warrant a little point-counterpoint. Richard Sheehan agreed, and he criticized us for being overly concerned with the money aspect of the story. Public radio, he wrote, is not a religious order requiring vows of poverty from those who lend it their talents. As for the man himself, emails were divided equally between those of you who miss him and those who breathed a sigh of relief for the radio silence, like Maja Monk from Santa Rosa, California, who wrote, I hope this little piggy goes wah, wah, wah all the way home. Curtis Deutsch emailed us from Princeton University a few weeks ago, troubled by a funding announcement he had heard. Listeners were informed that NPR is brought to us in part by Kuwait, he wrote, whose people and government wish to thank America for protecting it. What disturbed Mr. Deutsch further was that the announcement followed a news item on the recent bombing of Iraq. Does this jeopardize NPR's objectivity, he asks. Well, he didn't hear that on our show, although I understand we're negotiating with the Taliban. In any event, later in this segment, reporter Melinda Pankava looks into the private funders of public broadcasting. Just for you, Curtis Deutsch.
Public relations people know the best way to get you to buy is to put the pitch in the mouth of someone you trust, a neutral party. Better yet, an expert. In the new book called Trust Us, where experts, Sheldon Rampton and John Stauber, examine how supposed bona fide experts are bankrolled and found that frequently they are anything but neutral. John Stauber joins us now. John, the use of the so-called third-party ploy seems to have skyrocketed lately. I assume that's because so much commerce is based on the idea of better living through chemistry?
If a chemical company says a pesticide is safe, we tend not to trust them because what else are they going to say? It's their product. They have a vested interest. So the public is naturally skeptical. But if a scientist who's with an apparent public interest organization like the American Council on Science and Health says the same thing and it's reported in the media, we tend to trust that third-party expert because, after all, they've been vetted by journalists. They're with a nonprofit organization. It has a noble-sounding name. However, if we knew that the American Council on Science and Health was heavily funded by industry, that the scientist had a pro-industry bias, and that, in fact, the journalist who had written the story wasn't revealing this and had just simply taken the information and passed it on, that would certainly make us skeptical.
One place where we see a lot of experts used, I assume a lot of third-party technique is being employed as well, is in the area of health and food and drugs. Any campaigns from any of those areas that would illustrate this point?
Well, these campaigns are very ongoing. These days, Dennis Avery, who's with the Hudson Institute, is promoting the idea that food grown without pesticides and fertilizers that's certified organic, we might think it's safer, but actually it's more likely to kill us with the deadly E. coli. What happened with this issue is that John Stossel of ABC's 2020 featured Dennis Avery in a report that aired more than once, and it just scared the bejeebers out of people who figured that John Stossel's a good investigative reporter, and here's somebody presented as an independent expert who's telling us that organic food is going to kill us. Well, what John Stossel didn't point out was that Dennis Avery is with this industry-funded think tank, that he's on a crusade to smear organic food. And what was even more interesting, eventually the New York Times revealed this, is that the information was completely concocted. And John Stossel was forced to issue a retraction.
Now, you mentioned that there are several front groups that have authoritative-sounding names, like the American Council on Science and Health, for instance, and the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. But there are groups that we know about, that we've come to trust, the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society. When they give their seal of approval to something, can we believe it?
Well, it's very possible that they're receiving hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in exchange. The American Cancer Society, for instance, received $1 million from SmithKline Beecham for allowing SmithKline Beecham the right to use its logo. And Bristol-Myers Squibb paid $600,000 to the American Heart Association for the right to display their logo in ads for the drug Pravacol. This, I can assure you, is just the tip of the iceberg, and it's one reason why I think it would be very helpful for all of us, consumers, journalists, the public at large, if nonprofit organizations that have tax-exempt status were required to reveal payments from industry.
So are there such things as truly independent experts?
These people, if they do exist, are very difficult to find.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
John Stauber, with his colleague Sheldon Rampton, wrote, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future.
Corporate funding frequently worries public broadcasting audiences. They wonder if the presumably non-commercial programs they enjoy are affected by the underwriters. We have some figures for you from late last year. Corporate grants account for roughly 15% of public broadcast funding. A quarter of the budget comes from subscribers, more for radio. Still more comes from local, state, and federal governments and from a wide variety of fundraising efforts. Foundations provide about 5% of public broadcasting's budget. Generally, audiences are not so concerned about foundation grants, but perhaps they ought to be. Foundation sponsors, like governments, sometimes have agendas. We asked reporter Melinda Pancava to look into the potential impact of foundations on programming.
If you were listening to National Public Radio in February, you may have heard this.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the state of Kuwait in memory of the 10th anniversary of Kuwait's liberation. On the web at KuwaitThanksAmerica.org.
The first time I heard it, I was on the air. The underwriting credit came on seconds before I was to begin discussing the U.S. airstrikes on Kuwait's neighbor, Iraq. There was barely time to register that the underwriter was a foreign government entwined with the topic I would be discussing. It didn't change how I was going to talk about the previous day's airstrikes, but I had to wonder if listeners might think that it did. The underwriting credit ran for 3 weeks. NPR's ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin says he heard from hundreds of listeners.
I was appalled. What concerned me and concerned others was the impression that would be left that NPR was being influenced by a sovereign government that is in the news from time to time. And it's also because NPR goes to Iraq to cover the ongoing story there.
NPR management said that the Kuwait money went to NPR's general news fund and not to specific coverage of Kuwait. But because that wasn't clear to listeners, NPR has since decided to change its policy. Ken Stern is NPR's executive vice president.
We're not going to take foreign government underwriting anymore.
Elsewhere in public radio, the daily business show Marketplace receives funding to cover Japan from the Japan Foundation, financed by the Japanese government. Jim Russell is general manager of Marketplace.
What happened very early in Marketplace's existence is that we determined that there were one or two places in the entire world that were absolutely essential and defining if one was going to do a global business and economic show, and Japan was one of them. After that decision was made, Public Radio International went out and looked for funding.
Usually when foundations give money to public broadcasting, what they want to see covered is not so much a geographic area, as in the case of Japan, as it is an area of concern. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation underwrites coverage of health on both NPR and Marketplace. Among the foundation's goals is having basic health care at a reasonable cost available to all. The Pew Charitable Trust has financed NPR's Changing Face of America series. One of its missions is to increase public trust in the election process. The Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation promotes entrepreneurship and underwrites coverage of that. NPR says that as a larger news organization, it has a thick firewall, a comfortable distance between its reporting and editing crew and the foundations who have provided money. And both NPR and Marketplace say that it is the news operations who come up with a list of areas they plan to cover first and then leave it to their fundraising sides to find foundations willing to underwrite it. But for Jim Ledbetter, author of Made Possible by The Death of Public Broadcasting in the U.S., it is irrelevant who approaches whom about funding.
This reminds me of Madonna explaining why it was okay for her to appear in a video in chains. And she said, you know, I put the chains on myself. Whether the initiative comes from the foundation or it comes from the stations or the producers, in the end, the result is the same. The editorial time is being tailored to a greater or lesser degree to the needs of the funders, rather than the editorial judgment of the executives.
NPR says most of its foundation contributions are earmarked for something specific or something as broad as international coverage. Marketplace says 10% of its budget relies on this. A recent check of the Marketplace archives found significantly more references to Japan, which it receives funding for, than to any other country. And James Ledbetter worries that if a foundation chooses to fund one area of coverage, short shrift could be given to another area that didn't catch the fancy of a foundation.
There's a scarcity of time. I mean, there's only a couple of hours a day that National Public Radio can devote to nationwide news programming. So you can just never know whether those topics would make it onto the air without that specific funding or not. It may not be pernicious influence, but it is undeniably a form of influence, and it's one that I think really has to be monitored very closely.
James Ledbetter says it can be harder to keep tabs on the links between foundations and programs that air on public TV. Lacking a central news operation, there is a more scattershot approach, with independent producers and individual stations looking for the financing for their documentaries.
Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now.
In 1996, KQED-TV in San Francisco produced and distributed a documentary on Paul Ehrlich, who is author of the book The Population Bomb. In the mid-60s, he had predicted calamity if the world's population were not brought under control.
Additional funding has been provided by the following foundations.
Peggy Lauer heads the Fred Gellert Foundation, which provided $50,000 for the Ehrlich Project. Her foundation wants to raise alarm on environmental and overpopulation issues, and so it funded the documentary.
We have a certain expectation, or not an expectation, but an assumption that certain information will come out that will probably support what our thoughts are.
Peggy Lauer says it is not as interesting to her to have an opposing view in a documentary, belittling her concerns.
If it's too balanced, then it's then you're taking a lot out, or you're confusing the issue. You're muddying the waters.
Michael Schwartz was senior producer of the Paul Ehrlich documentary. As an independent producer, he has to find funding himself now, and says that he's never had a foundation exert editorial influence on him. He downplays the question of influence.
You know, foundations don't have a profit motive. Corporations do. And although foundations may have agendas, generally their agendas have to do with improving the world in some way.
Journalists, though, are trained to be on the lookout for agendas. Foundations may not have a profit motive, but they may capitalize on the underwriting more than a corporation, which sponsors a program to buy some goodwill. Corporations do not direct the funding to go to a certain area. Jim Russell's program Marketplace is underwritten by General Electric as well as by foundations.
I find really ironic that people are critical of big corporations, among them our major funder, GE, for what they perceive as a likelihood of conflict of interest or attempted influence peddling. The irony is that I think that's a greater problem with foundations than it's ever been with a corporation.
11 years ago, an NPR board member quit in opposition to the directed foundation money. Now it's established as a piece of the revenue pie, alongside contributions from listeners, corporations, and the government. Some suggest the piecemeal way that public radio has to finance itself keeps any one sector from exerting undue influence. Listeners and viewers may grumble about more and more underwriting credits showing up on the air, but in the end, for the news consumer, it might just be preferable to hear that full disclosure of who is paying the freight. For On the Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Coming up, reality TV for real. Documentarian R.J. Cutler takes American High to PBS. Also, Mary Richards is cast in Bronze, and movie blurbs. They're worse than you thought.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ottoman Empire, an empire with a mandate from Suleiman the Magnificent to promote the advancement and diffusion of Turkish artistic and military excellence.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Thank you.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last year, R.J. Cutler had a new plan for the cameras he'd used to capture Bill Clinton in the spin room and Oliver North in A Perfect Candidate. He'd go to high school and document a group of teenagers being teenagers, and he would air the results where teenagers were likely to see them, on the Fox network. Well, Cutler did go to a suburban Chicago school, and he did capture the highs.
I am pleased to offer you admission to the College of Arts and Science, the University of Colorado Boulder.
Yes!
And the lows.
Teenage dating process. I hate it. I want to
of teenage life. And Fox did air them for 4 episodes. And then, after being beaten in the ratings by Big Brother, the so-called reality show on CBS, Fox pulled the plug.
American High became Cutler's education in commercial broadcasting. This coming-of-age story has a happy ending, though. PBS agreed to air the series in its entirety beginning this week, and we'll finally get to learn if Morgan ever makes up with his parents.
If you were a decent student, I wouldn't care if you lived in a pigsty. But you're a lousy student, and you live in a pigsty, and you have rotten manners, and you have no respect. You are an absolutely obnoxious kid, and everything that's good about you only surfaces with people outside this house and the people that you want to impress.
Anything you got to say, Mom? Come on. You're the one who's full of words.
Just get out.
Shut that thing off.
Like I said, my mom and dad are real pricks.
R.J. Cutler, why did you think this show could be successful on the Fox network?
I mean, we designed American High from the beginning as the nonfiction version of my so-called life. And the idea was behind it, really, was that nonfiction, cinema verite storytelling could function in prime time.
Now, Fox had other problems at the time. They had a dramatic loss in viewership. Do you think they panicked?
I know that last summer was a tough summer for Fox. You know, in the words of one network executive who was speaking to me about it, we've got a network that's hemorrhaging and I got to do something to stop the bleeding. And I respect that. I think they made a mistake. And this is a show that has a devoted audience, an audience that remains to this day checking in every day on the website, emailing each other. Kids are, to this day, still into this show. And you'll see, I believe, when the show comes on PBS starting April 4th, that this community of viewers returns and the audience will build. PBS is extremely committed to the show. They're going to air it every Wednesday night at from 10 to 11 for a full 13-week run, and then they're going to re-air it for another 13 weeks consecutively after that.
So superficially, at least, this is the most counterintuitive move since, you know, Jed Clampett and his family headed for Beverly Hills. The idea of going from that venue to PBS is, you know, on the face of it, remarkable. But I guess it actually makes quite a bit of sense if you examine the subject matter of your documentary.
The subject matter, the form, the content, the history of a show like An American Family, which premiered on PBS 30 years ago and was the first reality series of them all. So it's not so unusual for PBS to be hosting this show.
Now that your series will have a presumably wide audience on PBS, and certainly will be given a run. I won't be canceled after 4 episodes, the way it was on Fox. Do you harbor any fantasy that the way you approach reality television as a documentarian will influence the way others have approached reality television and get rid of the, it might somehow push aside these preposterously contrived formats?
There are a number of different genres of nonfiction television show. There's the nonfiction game show. Survivor is the, I think, best produced example of that. There is the contrived reality drama. A show like The Real World functions that way. Making the Band is another program that does that. And then there are the true nonfiction drama series programs. Right now, ours is the only one that will be on the air. Come next year, there are a couple that are being developed. There are real nonfiction drama series shows made by real documentary filmmakers who go into other people's environments, go into their worlds. You know, we always say these kids in American High, they were going to high school, they were living their lives, they were having their relationships, they were dealing with the issues surrounding coming of age in America right now, whether we were there to film it or not. You cannot say that about any of these other programs. You know, it's a very simple formula. If our shows are successful, other shows like ours will follow.
Are you cutting the show? Are you yourself changing the content for this very clearly different audience?
We're not changing a frame of the show American High. Now, American High was a half-hour show on Fox, which meant it was 22 minutes of programming. Without commercials, it means we have approximately 4 or 5 more minutes of airtime in every half hour. So we have produced supplemental segments.
The 4 episodes that ran on Fox, I presume you will run them in similar form just to acquaint the viewers with the characters.
They will run in similar form, and the subsequent 9 episodes will run as they were originally produced for Fox. In addition, after every episode, there's a 5-minute segment of kind of look behind the scenes. How did we pick the kid? What was the diary class process like? The final episode will be succeeded by a where am I now segment that the kids themselves have contributed new diaries to. So it's that kind of thing. But the show is no different than what we cut for Fox.
Mr. Cutler, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
R.J. Cutler is the executive producer of American High, which airs on PBS on Wednesdays at 10 p.m.
I really, really, like, love Teddy a lot. Like, wow.
Fictional news producer Mary Richards was in the news recently in Minneapolis. The character, played by Mary Tyler Moore, is being offered in the form of a bronze statue to the city she made famous. Minnesota Public Radio's Marisa Helms reports.
First-time visitors to Minneapolis are usually looking for Mary Richards. They want to know where she lives and where she works. Face it, Mary Richards is Minneapolis, and there are some who are pretty proud of that, including the mayor, Sharon Sales Belton.
There are really quite a few women out there who watch the Mary Tyler Moore show and really thought that her character helped to affirm the fact that women can be in major leadership roles and can break through that glass ceiling.
Talks over the gift from TV Land began last summer. The cable company is offering to pay for all costs of commissioning and erecting Mary Richards. They aren't saying how much they're dropping on the statue, which would be the second in a series TV Land hopes to put up around the country. The first was of Ralph Cramden from The Honeymooner Show. That was put up at the Port Authority in New York City. In Minneapolis, resident Tim Connolly ponders the statue of Hubert Humphrey near the entrance to City Hall. He says that if the city's going to put up a statue, it should honor someone who did something of political or social significance.
Why is TV Land putting up this statue? Is it marketing? If it's marketing and the mayor is buying into it, then we are complicit in marketing TV Land Network.
It's like honoring a unicorn. You know, it's honoring something that doesn't exist.
Clay Steinman is a communications studies professor at McAllister College in St. Paul.
The world that's being shown by that statue is not one that anyone lives in. It's a fictional world that was constructed by MTM to sell to CBS, who used it in order to sell audiences to advertisers. That's a very different thing, I think, a very, very different kind of phenomenon than honoring someone from the past, like Eleanor Roosevelt, who might give us a clue of how to live well and be a better person in the world.
But can't a make-believe character provide real-life inspiration?
Those fictionalized characters are very, very real to millions and millions of people.
TV Land executive Larry Jones says the statue will offer a reminder of hours well spent in front of the tube.
I see that as a benefit on a long term that's not about a corporate agenda, but it's about an agenda that supports, you know, a great American television icon. And it'll be something that generations to come can enjoy.
The Minneapolis Office of Cultural Affairs says by fall there will be a statue of Mary somewhere on downtown's Nicollet Mall. Artists' proposals from across the country are starting to come in. Public Art Administrator Mary Altman says, among other criteria, they'll consider how the artist handles the challenge of the hat. One proposal suggests multiple wistful swirls of metal rods that symbolize wind. The rods will connect the finger and the hat in the triumphant moment when it leaves her fingertips. For On the Media, this is Marisa Helms.
Who can turn the world on with a smile? Who can take a nothing day? Suddenly make it all seem worthwhile. What it's good and you should know it. Each glance and every little movement you show it.
Love is all around.
No need to fake it.
You can never
tell. Why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all. How will you make
This year's Best Picture, Gladiator, walked away with 5 Academy Awards. So any problems it may have had attracting audiences, as if it needed any more, disappeared. Other films are not so fortunate, but if they are something less than contemporary classics, you'd never know it by their overheated advertising.
A few months back, New York Times film critic Elvis Mitchell screened the movie 15 Minutes, for which he wrote a complex, ambivalent review. He credited the film for storytelling impact, but ultimately dismissed it for trading in the very cynical manipulation it purports to expose. Curiously, considering his generally negative tone, the movie ads for 15 Minutes quoted Mitchell. Not the part of his review that said, "big turnoff," but the part that said, "fleet-footed, merciless entertainment." Mitchell was a little surprised.
I never thought of merciless as being a compliment unless you were Genghis Khan, but, you know, I don't work for a movie studio.
That was not exactly an isolated incident. Andrew Johnston, writing about the flop Baby Geniuses in Us Weekly, compared the film unfavorably to 101 Dalmatians. The 101 Dalmatians part made it to the cover of the Video Box. The unfavorably, needless to say, did not. And the Sacramento Bee's Joe Baltocchi saw a movie called Next Friday that provoked him to use the word shameless in his review. Not masterful, not transcendent, shameless. It showed up in the ads as if it were a superlative. Welcome to the world of movie marketing, a fifth dimension of context wherein critics' words or phrases are cut, pasted, trimmed, rearranged, and generally defiled in the name of suggesting journalistic endorsement, whether real or imagined. Elvis Mitchell.
They're put together like ransom notes, you know, a word at a time.
Aris Christofidis operates the website critics.com.
Studio PR people, they seem to be the masters of the ellipses. The best one this year, it's from a DVD of a movie called Immortality. And the quote in the bag is, in quotation marks, Jude Law, ellipses, terrific. Film.com. Now, I went to film.com and tried to find if there was a review of Immortality, and there isn't. What they did was simply to take the name Jude Law and take the terrific out of a review of a movie that Jude Law was involved in and simply put it on the DVD box, and there you have it.
So, yeah, when you see extremely brief bursts of apparent gusto attributed to name-brand critics, it's safe to assume they've been printed out of context, almost always with one or more exclamation points appended to suggest even more critical enthusiasm. Exclamations, Mitchell assures, never show up in actual reviews, unless meant ironically.
Outside of the Marvel comics of the 1960s, when Spider-Man, even with his thoughts, had exclamation points at the end of them, no, I don't know anybody who uses exclamation points.
Of course, most often, if you read the fine print, you're apt to discover that the critics quoted are not from the New York Times of the world. They're from the KMAX TV Channel 31 Sacramentos of the world. Andrew Johnston of Us calls them quote machines, seduced by free junkets to studio events where they get to briefly interview stars in exchange for fulsome blurb material. But the movie ads print the raves in big type and the source in fine print, elevating the obscure to Ebertian status. Andrew Johnston.
There are, you know, people from, you know, small market TV stations who are willing to just, like, basically say whatever the studio wants them to say to get their name in the paper.
And if just the right words don't spring to mind, no worries. The studios apparently are happy to provide those as well. Tim Gray follows the blurb wars for Daily Variety.
The funny thing is the quotes keep staying the same. The names keep changing, but you'll always see, you know, funny, funny, funny. You will never forget, fill in the name of the movie. You know, the most fun you'll have this summer. You know, all those quotes, they keep reappearing every year.
A lot of them are attributed to a particularly ubiquitous blurbographer by the name of Jeff Craig of a mysterious media outlet called 60 Second Preview. Craig is quoted everywhere, and he is always deliriously excited about the movie. He loved Cheryl Ladd in Permanent Midnight. Free Willy 3 was breathtaking. The Kevin Pollak Cheryl Lee Ralph vehicle titled Deterrence wasn't one of the top 10 of the year. It was one of the most important films of our time. Now there's a movie lover. So we naturally wanted to speak to him, but we couldn't find 60 Second Preview, not any trace of it. Anywhere we looked, we don't even know what medium it is.
I have no idea who he is. I have no idea what he does. I have no idea where he's published, if he's published somewhere. It's a great mystery.
Critic.com's Aris Christofides.
He's very enthusiastic. There is no doubt about that. Anybody that enthusiastic has to be alive.
We had the same difficulty finding a movie studio interested in discussing this topic. We called six of them, and they all declined to answer questions about blurbation. But if the studios have created this parallel universe of irrational exuberance, that doesn't mean there are no natural forces working in their favor. Between the grotesquely twisted, ellipses-filled, exclamation-appended cut-and-paste blurb and the bought-and-paid-for quid pro quo of blurb whoredom, there is the just-plain friendly practitioner, Variety's Tim Gray.
There's a guy named Lou Luminick at the New York Post who last year in March called What Planet Are You From? The funniest movie of the year, and then a few months later called Best in Show, the year's funniest movie. You figure, all right, it's 6 months have passed. It's like, yeah, that's enough. That counts as a year.
Lou Luminick, are you a soft touch?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I basically like movies. You know, there are different kinds of critics. I mean, there are critics who are basically focused on nitpicking and tearing movies apart. I mean, I'm working for a tabloid. I'm basically doing a consumer guide. I mean, is the film worth going to see or not?
Luminick also acknowledges sometimes getting a kick out of seeing himself quoted here and there. To him, it's a minor bonus. To Owen Gleiberman, who reviews films for Entertainment Weekly, that little thrill is quite sinister, a sort of ego payola pervading the trade, fundamentally skewing the judgment of even the most established critics.
It's vanity. When you see a quote of yours in a movie ad, it can make you feel important. It shouldn't, because it doesn't make you important. But there are people who really get off on it. And it can
well, how about you, Owen Gleiberman? Have you ever gotten a little charge or even a big one?
Yes, I've gotten the charge. I'll admit it.
For the record, Elvis Mitchell of the New York Times unequivocally denies any ego satisfaction out of being cited, which he sees as merely a byproduct of his labors.
The blurb is just, well, what's the negative of gravy? Whatever that would be, that's what a blurb is.
In any event, next time you plunk down $8 to see the feel-good hit of the summer, make sure you've read the fine print, extrapolated to account for the ellipses, and most of all, considered the source. You might also want to make sure it isn't still June.
Well, Hugh, as Barbara Walters would say, that was eye-opening. What's a moviegoer to do?
Well, one thing you might consider is saving $5 and going to the video store to rent M instead, you know, with Peter Lorre. Don't think of it as a downer. Think of it as the feel-bad hit of all time. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk, Kathleen Horan, and, of course, John Keefe. Amy Pearl oversees our website.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison produced our theme, and Bob Garfield, with his wife Milena this week, produced Ida Rose Garfield. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, another Garfield. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Bye, Dad.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Cardassian Empire, providing tractor beam support technology since Stardate 44429.6, and the House of Plantagenet. Visit us on the web at plantagenet.net.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.